Welcome to the Welcome to the Security Weekly News wrap up for the week of 25 April, the last week of April. LSD, government intervention and ransomware, Joe's response to Russia, not that Joe, but the current Joe. Password state, AI, MITRE, Chrome, and all the show updates.
This is Security Weekly. For security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you an important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News. Cyber criminals are working overtime. They're leveraging activity around the COVID vaccine to disguise phishing attacks, hoping to steal money or personal information from your employees or customers. The Barracuda Email Threat Scanner is a free tool you can use right now to help protect your business and ultimately your reputation. The Barracuda Email Threat Scanner analyzes your Office 365 accounts and identifies malicious emails that slip past your gateway and into inboxes. Find the cybersecurity threats hiding in your Office 365 email. Use the Barracuda Email Threat Scanner for free right now at securityweekly.com/Barracuda. As technology continues to evolve and expand, so have the attackers that put our critical systems in jeopardy. Core Impact from Core Security is a penetration testing tool that safely finds vulnerabilities using the same techniques of adversaries, with certified exploits and wizards that guide you through critical pen tests while maximizing the time of advanced testers by automating their routines. With Core Security, you can safeguard your infrastructure by limiting access, detecting threats, testing for security weaknesses, and efficiently monitoring data. Visit securityweekly.com/core security.
All right, I'm Doug White from Roger Williams University. Let's wrap up all the show topics for the week, because you want shows, we got shows. On Application Security Weekly, number 148, John and Mike had two segments of discussions. One titled Deceptive Diffs from Subversive Submitters, and they were what they were talking about was a research paper that was called Researchers Secretly Tried to Add Vulnerabilities to Linux Kernel, Ending Up Getting Banned. So this was a pretty big story this week. It was a Linux kernel issue. And so they were basically, this was like a almost academic kind of paper they were talking about. So it's a pretty interesting topic. And then they actually had two segments about this thing. So if you're interested in that, it would be a great show to check out. On Business Security Weekly, number 214, Paul, Jason, and Matt, I'm not sure Paul was there actually, had Matthew Gourget, the CEO at Vigitrust, and he was on to talk about cyber accountability and how cyber accountability is often overlooked by the C-suite and the board, and how the SolarWinds thing and like proxy logon and all these other supply chain attacks have proven that cyber accountability is not just a strategy. And certainly a lot of us have talked about that for years, about you'll see people saying, you know, we are into, it's kind of, I mean, not to get political, it's like diversity. You see a lot of companies say we're into diversity, but then you kind of say, well, what are you doing about it? And it turns, you know, and then they do the same thing with cybersecurity. They say, well, we're really committed to cybersecurity, but then you go, yeah, but what do you actually do about cybersecurity? And you get kind of a blank stare. In the second segment, outgun CISOs navigate complex obstacles to keep rising attacks from turning into breaches. How to write a cyber threat report executives can really use. A good topic there. Creating and rolling out an effective cybersecurity strategy. And of course, they had quite a few other stories. I always just pick a few off their list. On Enterprise Security Weekly 225, Matt Tyler and Tyler Shields, so Tyler Robinson, Tyler Shields, had Rickard Carlson, the co-founder and CEO at Detectify, on to talk about collaboration as the modern approach to application security. So this is more of the shifting left kind of stuff to some degree. But they're also talking a lot about transparency, collaboration, and sharing your security information beyond your borders. So how do you actually work within your industry or even within the, you know, the global world to share security information? So it's a pretty interesting segment on that. The second segment was with Joseph Carson, the chief security scientist and advisory Cisco at Thycotic. And Joseph was talking about how authentication and authorization are two distinct security processes. And boy, are they. This was primarily about privilege and identity. and how those two big issues are not really the same thing. And a lot of people seem to think they are, but privilege is really difficult. And that's that sort of granularity and identity management that gets so hard to define. I mean, we used to talk about that all the time with clients when we're auditing or whatever. And you're looking at it and you're going, you know, they say, well, everybody's an accountant or everybody is an IT person. And it's like, yeah, but you need to get a lot more finer than that if you really want to actually do privilege management. So this is what the segment was about. And they had a new segment for the third segment. They actually did the news second segment, though. If I recall, the news was in the second segment, so I put it in the wrong order. On Security and Compliance Weekly number 7-1, Flea, Jeff, Josh, and Scott were talking with Richard Struess, the director from the Center for Threat-Informed Defense at MITRE Ingenuity. And the topic was about what is threat-informed defense. So you may have heard me introduce that and go, what the hell is that? And so this is a good segment to check that out. And, of course, viewing security posture using the attack framework. So it's a very popular thing to be doing these days. Attack framework is really interesting. It's a really great way to visualize. And to me, it's an even better way to help others visualize what you're talking about. I mean, at least that's how we found that useful. So a great segment, check that out. And of course, they continued that into the second segment. On Security Weekly News number 117, Jason Wood talked about Port Swigger's blog, which was a report about Versa AI. And the topic was really about how the security component of AI is being neglected. And I'm going to talk about that in my little rant, too. So I that was very interesting to me. So you can check that out. On Paul's Security Weekly number 692. So I don't know if you noticed this, but Paul was away last week. And basically, that's an unusual event. In fact, my challenge was met by Tracer T on Discord to figure out and how many times Paul had actually missed in like the last, I don't remember how many years I said, but, and it was really only like three or four times in the last many years. So it's very strange when Paul's not around. It's kind of like a disturbance in the force or something. And you kind of wonder if he's like lurking over there somewhere and he's going to spring out at you suddenly. Anyway, Paul did return last night and the show went on. First up was Fleming Schutt, the CTO of Barracuda Networks. And Fleming was talking about the vulnerabilities of hybrid workforces and how this is going to be permanent and how it's going to permanently alter the way in which we all work, meaning, you know, that people are going to start, nobody's going to want to go back to we all go into the cube farm every day. We've had over a year of this now, and some people will have to go in, but I think you're going to see a lot more of this hybridization going forward, and so did Fleming on the show last night. And of course, then he went on to talk about how zero trust is going to have to be a real thing in the next few years. In the second segment, Fred Gordy, the director of cybersecurity at Intelligent Briefings, was on talking about how there are 87 billion square feet of commercial real estate. And a lot of that commercial real estate has smart building controls, and becomes more so every day. And, you know, when people replace thermostats, when they replace fire sensors, when they replace smoke sensors, CO2, and so on, a lot of that has been replaced with smart IoT type devices, and that creates a massive threat surface. And of course, in the third segment, they had the security news. So my favorite threat of the week is going to be AIML. And this was really inspired by Jason's story on Tuesday. And of course, this is one of my favorite topics. It's definitely one of my favorite sci-fi things. I'm a huge William Gibson fan, a huge, you know, Philip K. Dick fan and so forth. And just a huge AIML in general fan. I've taken lots and lots of, whenever I had the opportunity, I was taking, you know, graduate programming courses and things in AIML stuff. Very, very fun, very cool stuff. It's very elaborate. But, you know, so and just to review for some of our listeners, AI is, of course, where you program a system that tries to behave like a human. So these are systems that use decision trees or they use other decision-making criteria that you try to have emulate human decision-making techniques, and you would expect it to then behave that way. So that's where the AI thing came from. But humans obviously don't always behave in appropriate ways, and as such, it can be difficult. And some decisions are not easily understood, even in AI. And what humans did is not always clear, as we've seen. trying to make AI-enabled vehicles and things like that. Pretty big challenge. AI-enabled cybersecurity professionals, very challenging thing to do, despite what marketing may say. Why did you take that next shot at tequila and end up with a tattoo on your face that says smoking? But, you know, it happens. ML, on the other hand, is a whole different animal, and ML can be a kind of basic thing like neural nets and things like that, but it really is supposed to be a learning algorithm. So it should start from, you know, kind of scratch and end up somewhere else, and you train these algorithms and then turn them loose. So you give a training data set to this. Some of the first projects I worked on was with loans, and I was working on that with my friend Lou. And, you know, trying to build better ways to determine this. But we didn't decide what it was going to be. We just turned it loose and let it learn. And you see this with chat bots, and you see this with troll bots, and so on and so forth. And, of course, this is how you end up with all these dystopian visions like Blade Runner and Terminator. You know, but at the same time, despite all the Terminators, we really still pursue this. And by pursue it, I mean we start up these things and hope they don't go crazy and come looking for all the humans. And I'm certainly not anti-ML by any means. But the ideas of ML are that these concepts could rapidly become incomprehensible to humans. And that, and certainly we stand on the brink of this. I mean, we're right now in this time in history at the brink of true ML kind of stuff. And we already see some of that. And that's going to change the way the world works. An MIT professor has said, as has Elon Musk, who actually gave odds on this somehow. I don't even know how he came up with it. But that we're all just simply objects living in a simulation, and that we reach this level of being able to create our own simulation, we will sort of will go up like a celluloid collar. Kurt Vonnegut always said that. But the point is not that ML is a threat or that AI is a threat. But I will reiterate from Jason's discussion on Tuesday that we need to find ways to understand what the threats will actually be to these systems. I mean, ML is a lot like many other technological advances. And in the initial days, we want to get it working. So everybody, you know, you have academics and you have industry pursuing it. But we may be leaving out important components like security, like cybersecurity stuff from the starting point, because we just want to get it to work. And if we do that, these systems may evolve beyond our ability to actually make them shift left or to inject these things into them. And then they may be vulnerable to human attack. And that's how you get Terminators. I mean, it's also how you get systems we don't even understand that are vulnerable to all sorts of attacks we may not even understand, a la William Gibson, Neuromancer kind of stuff. The flip side of the argument, of course, is that what if they're vulnerable to human attack, and yet they can actually deal with that human attack better than we could ever possibly. And of course, that's also how you get Terminators. So it kind of sounds like we're pretty much doomed either way. So, you know, what the hell? I mean, let's just have fun. Wasn't that what Oppenheimer said when he was going to set off the first nuclear weapon? It was kind of like, ah, what the hell? Actually, he said something much more profound than that, but that's why I'm not there. And yeah. That's where he made that "I am become death" speech. Yeah, it's very, very profound. Anyway, and the news. A multi-government task force is gunning for ransomware gangs, which sounds like the plot of a virtual Old West movie, like a virtual Western. You know, we're going to go get them gangs. A posse of 60 government groups rides out onto the digital range to hunt down the old WannaCry gang that are hiding in the old virtual crypto mine. And, well, all the other gangs that are out there, I mean, besides WannaCry, of course. The Institute for Security and Technology put this group together, and it includes commercial, government, vendors, financials, nonprofits, and universities, along with the usual cast of the Department of Justice, Europol, NCSC, which are all these federal level agencies in this case, the United States, the EU, and Britain, respectively, and of course, and many others. An 81-page document was written up and delivered to President Biden and his administration this week with an outline of a very, what was described in this article I posted, a very aggressive agenda for the task force. The document included all the usual approaches. That when I didn't read the document, but I was reading the summary of it. It sounded like a lot of the usual stuff about sharing information, which of course is really important. I mean, that's something a lot of these law enforcement agencies and industry do not do well. And putting pressure on Russia and, of course, all the other safe havens for ransomware gangs like North Korea and so forth. And alongside of that, with tax breaks to cyber companies pursuing this and large and probably the university grants to universities and things like that and large scale awareness campaigns. You know, it's like, hey, kids, just say no to ransomware. Sometimes I don't know how much those awareness campaigns work, but maybe they do. I don't know. We've been talking about ransomware and phishing for what? 50 years and people still get fished left and right. So I don't know if it works or not. And I mean, we spent a lot of money on that Just Say No to Drugs campaign. Didn't work. According to this next story, 63% of cybersecurity experts who were surveyed by the Cybersecurity 202 said that the Biden administration, these experts said the Biden administration had done enough to respond to the Russian hacking of SolarWinds software. I thought that was an interesting response. I wasn't sure I felt that way, but you know, I mean, it seemed like this really big attack, and then what you get back is just some, you know, the usual stuff. But the response was described in an appropriate show of force proportionate to Russia's actions in the attack. So basically, the response was sanctions against Russia. I mean, which is something that's been going on since what, the 1950s. And so this started to sound a lot like another old story. We had an old Western to start with, now even another old Cold War spy novel. So sanctions against Russia, sanctions against six Russian companies, and the expelling of 10 Russian officials. I don't know how they pick who they're going to expel, but you know, it's probably that guy that's really obnoxious. And so they say, okay, you're out. But it really sounded like the Cold War to me, because that this is exactly the kind of news stories you used to see. You know, the Soviets would be caught in New York City with some kind of an antenna, and then they would expel some Soviet officials, and then the Russians would expel some U.S. officials, and on and on and on. Anyway, the article has a lot of quotes from a lot of the big name players in the cybersecurity field, so you might want to read it. I did notice that Mark Weatherford is somebody that I know. He said he wasn't impressed with the response and said the response should have been painful enough so that others won't choose to do this kind of stuff. Okay. I agree with him. I mean, but apparently a lot of people have felt that it was painful enough. So maybe it is. It's hard to tell. MITRE ATT&CK has released the official attack matrix for containers. So the new matrix covers both orchestration level, and that is container management tools like Kubernetes, as well as the container level. So that's stuff like Docker. So if you are using containers, which have a lot of security issues, this is definitely a tool you might want to check out. Again, like I said earlier, the MITRE ATT&CK frameworks are really useful for illustrating what points you're trying to make. So if you're trying to help your team, or better, some of the upper management people understand what you're trying to do or why you need to do it, this is definitely a great place to start. I'm a big fan, so definitely check that out if you're using containers, which you probably are. You may not know it. I hope you know it, but you may not. So, researchers found an Apple AirDrop vulnerability, which includes two main issues, which sound like the same issue to me, but one of the issues was that it could expose the sender's details, and the other issue was, well, it exposed the receiver's details. So it sounds like the same issue, and you know, I guess either side can see the other side. Basically what it is, it's a hashing contact identifier that occurs during the AirDrop connection, and this is a hash which you can reverse. And because you can reverse it, it would allow either party to extract the phone number, email, and other stuff of the other person. Obviously, you know, this is one of those things where if you go to public hotspots and start airdropping things, and I remember years and years ago, I took my daughter when she was younger to a concert, and we set up the identity on our phone to be Ed Sheeran, and people were trying to airdrop photos to us, and I was thinking, you know, this could be a huge threat. So it may create a big risk for you if that's the kind of thing that you are doing. Apple has not patched this, and if you have AirDrop on your device and you're doing airdrops to people, it is vulnerable. The workaround that Apple suggested and others was to use Private Drop, which doesn't use that same hashing algorithm. Since Google Chrome seems to be playing whack-a-mole with vulnerabilities lately and issuing updates at just a frantic pace. I mean, it seems like every other day I go to my machine and it's got the update light is on. Another collection of Chrome vulnerabilities was patched this week, which includes yet another V8 bug that could allow remote code execution on the platform. This one was CVE-2021-21227. It's in the article, and was reported by Singular Security Lab. Not much about it was known, except that it's an insufficient data validation issue in the V8 engine. So this is similar to some other issues that they had already patched. They did say the bug did not allow code execution outside of the sandbox. And, you know, but some people, for whatever reason, disable sandboxing. I don't know why you would do that, but people do. So if you do allow unsandboxing or disabled sandboxing of apps, that would be really, really bad. So don't turn it off. But all in all, Google rolled out 9 patches this week for Chrome, bringing Chrome to version like 90 dot and some long number after that. But so if you haven't patched that up or had your users patch it up, it's probably a good idea to do so. In an effort to facilitate patch management on the same lines, Microsoft this week announced an enterprise-only, I hate it when they do that, an enterprise-only capability in Windows that will allow something people have been asking for since the dawn of time, rollbacks of individual non-security elements of updates. You know, they put out these update patches and they have stacks of things in them. You don't even know necessarily what they all are. And your only choice is to either install it all or don't install it all. Very simple, except for the fact that when something crashes or it doesn't work, you basically have to roll back the entire update. So this is called known issue rollback, or Cure, which they've been calling it, Cure Royale. I don't know. But the Cure Royale is always a fun drink to have in France. But basically, it's response to everybody. You know, they used to just force you to do it all or nothing, and updates, which contained a lot of fixes, came out at the same time. So when things break, then you have to undo the whole fix. And it also means that testing and patching is a very long process, and you have to worry about a larger set of updates. So they finally are allowing people to roll back individual pieces of patches. So yay, Microsoft, but why don't you let everybody do that? Password State Password Manager had an update hijack embedded in it, which installed a backdoor Trojan on users' PCs. This is an Australian product, and it experienced a breach between the 20th of April and the 22nd of April, and the compromise was reported by, Nebezpieczeństwo, which is a Polish tech service. Sorry for the pronunciation. I apologize to all my Polish friends. This software has about 29,000 customers worldwide and roughly 370,000 users worldwide, and claimed it was a sophisticated supply chain attack with not a, there are some more details in the article. The update was a zip archive, which was supposedly contained, it contained an upgrade, was sent out, but it really had a DLL in it, which was a framework. When that executed, it downloaded a payload from a command and control server. The command and control server was apparently taken down on the 22nd of April after the breach was discovered. So, you know, if you're using that product, you may want to look into that. They did have recommendation that you change all your credentials and so forth, which really sucks when it's a password vaulting system. The Internet Systems Consortium released updates for the BIN-D DNS software, which they patched several vulnerabilities and had released the 3 new advisories for BIN-D. BIN-D is the backbone of DNS, of course. Some people say bind. I say BIN-D. If you don't like it, well, that's just the way it goes. It's widely used, obviously, and has a long history of being exploited. These 3 new flaws are fairly serious, but they did say they had not seen any attacks on these vulnerabilities actually in the wild. Anyway, BIN-D's always been problematic, so be sure you keep any DNS servers patched up if you're running that daemon. And finally, now I had to clean up Lou's computers every now and then when he would ask me to come help him. And one time we were moving this large monitor that he had. It was a giant ViewSonic CRT. It was huge. And he wanted to move it and clean it up because we were gonna give it away. And I got so much nicotine on my hands just carrying it. It was on my hands and arms. I really started to feel sick. And I had to wear gloves the rest of the time we were working on this thing. But it was nothing like this story. A sound engineer in San Francisco was apparently cleaning up a bunch of old components that he found at Caltech. And they were from the 60s. And he found an old synth Buchla Model 100. This is a very famous keyboard and a synthesizer. One of those big ones with all the wires and knobs and everything. And it was in a closet at Cal State. And apparently, it was covered in LSD. which, if you don't know what LSD is, well, it's a well-known hallucinogen. And it was widely used slash abused, enjoyed, whatever, however you feel about it, in the 1960s. And apparently, and I had never heard this before, but this was in the story, apparently back then, and if Lou was still around, I would have called him and asked him about it. They used to dip their fingers in a liquid LSD and touch the keys on instruments and things. I don't know what that's supposed to do. I guess when you're playing on stage, then you like get, you know, freaked out. It would be pretty weird, but it sounds strange to me. But apparently that was what had happened, and this guy says that he was touching this keyboard and he tripped for 9 hours from it. So all my old instruments are just covered in dust and cat hair, but you know, whatever. And that's a news wrap up for the week of 25 April 2021 in the time of plague. I will get my last shots next week, and then I'm off to the nudist colony to do body shot. So see you next week on Security Weekly News.